Okay. Welcome back to the California Water Fix Aquatic Science Peer Review Phase 2B. This is day two of the review, and yesterday the panel received presentations on the materials related to what's in their charge. And this portion of the meeting is focused on having the panel provide their initial recommendations and really a dialogue between the presenters and the panel on those initial findings. Just a few logistics. Please remember to turn off your cell phones or silence them. The restrooms are located out the back. You'll need a restroom key. The panel's initial recommendations will be refined over the next little over a month, and they'll be providing their final recommendations on this review to select staff of the Delta Science Program by February 27th. And we will post the final report on the review webpage as soon as possible after. As stated in the meeting notice, the order of agenda items are subject to change, and we'll do our best to stay on track. Presentations from yesterday and from today will be archived in the archived webcast will be posted to the review webpage, as well as the individual presentations, including the panel's initial recommendations. So I guess without further ado, I will pass it over to our panel chair, Cy Simonstad, to lead the initial recommendations, but do want to note that in addition to the five panel members that are here today, John Van Sickle, who participated in the Phase 1 and Phase 2A review, has also contributed to these initial recommendations and will contribute to the final reports as well. So, Cy?
I just will comment that he was online yesterday, and we've had an exchange, so his input is represented here to some degree. He won't be able to defend it, but it's represented. So do we have the... Okay. So you move to the over. So there's a few overarching comments here, the panel really appreciates the phenomenal sort of response on assembling the analysis and the detail of the reviews between our first phase, 2A, and this phase. And found that most of our comments in our 2A presentation and summary were addressed to some degree. As we sort of discussed yesterday, the panel still feels that there's a real need, not only for us, but I think anybody trying to wrap their heads around California Water Fix needs to see the big picture, relationship amongst the different components, the sequencing, schedules and timelines, what elements are contingent on other elements, and particularly cumulative effects at the delta scale. And as we said, we think maybe a schematic would really help everybody sort of understand the complexities of this process. Next. Overall, we recognize we're really not here to evaluate decisions. We're here to evaluate the adequacy of the analytical approach and the use of best available science and really generally improve of the analytical methods, especially sort of the advancement in those over the past two phases that they've used to the services you have used to evaluate the effects. There's good evidence from the best available science of some significant adverse impacts to species and to critical habitat. However, we didn't find necessarily the details regarding how to avoid, minimize, and mitigate the impact is compelling, recognizing that, especially after discussions yesterday, that there's still a lot of process to go before we get to that detail. But we do sort of mention that sort of lack of detail and the huge uncertainties really demand a robust adaptive management framework to guide that. Given that long list of critical gaps and uncertainties that was identified in our earlier documentation, really needs to be prioritized particularly to identify the information that would inform adaptive management triggers and thresholds. And the best examples are the major uncertainties about delta smelt and longfin smelt vital rates and critical population parameters. And, of course, there needs to be some certainty and assurance that funding to gather that information in research and monitoring needs to be initiated immediately, is what we would say. So we've got sort of the list of the questions and categories that we'll go through here. And I'll just start out with the first one. There we go. Again, just to emphasize, we found an overall major improvement in the material and the analyses. The one thing that we really felt was still missing is really a failure to sort of treat the delta as this broad freshwater to bay to ocean system, whereas the individual species and concerns are integrated across their habitat and the effects of the manipulation of the system, particularly water withdrawal. And I think the next we'll move to Hannah.
I get the honor of translating to you from South Africa, from John Van Sickle. This is not my comment, but for the record, since this is being recorded, I'll just read this out loud. You'll have it to ponder later in the slide here. But the analytical approach, this has to do with uncertainty and weights of evidence issues, coming from John Van Sickle. The analytical approach defines high, medium, and low weights of evidence. It's unclear if these weights are equivalent to the high, low, medium certainties that are stated in sections 2511 on construction and 2522 on upstream operations. However, such certainties are not stated in 2522 under delta operations. If they are not equivalent, then what are the criteria for defining high, medium, low certainty? And how would these designations differentially influence the ultimate assessment of risk and exposure? Also, the paragraph preceding Table 2.2 in the analytical approach now mentions uncertainty, as the panel suggested in Phase 1 review, but it is still unclear how weights of evidence and or certainty designations, high, medium, low, will help determine the not likely true-false decisions in Tables 2.2 and 2.3. We suggest stating whether these determinations are to remain pure judgment calls. And I'm reminded why I'm a social scientist. Okay. Adaptive management. We as far as how you responded to Phase 1 comments, one thing we mentioned in Phase 1, we recognized the we talked about the need for more clarification on adaptive management. We note that the analytical approach does recognize the important role of adaptive management to reduce uncertainty around effectiveness of efforts to minimize impact on species. The NIMS document points to the robust 100-page framework, and we just wanted to remind you that while it is 100 pages and it's a great start, we do feel like there's a fair number of details missing from that framework that still need to be filled in order to reduce critical uncertainties with regard to the proposed action. And the panel appreciates the commitment to include monitoring for effects of climate change in the adaptive management plan and to adjust planning in response to feedback from adaptive management and real-time operations. One thing we asked for in the Phase 1 comments was better articulation of the links between adaptive management and real-time operations. And although the agencies acknowledged that or pointed out that there really wasn't going to be a connection, it still seems a little bit unclear because in some places, like here in the NIMFS biop, the draft biop, there's some text that says that real-time operations and adaptive management will be designed to incorporate uncertainty and allow action within reasonable timeframes for those activities, given opportunities or scenarios to address uncertainties. So it sounds like there's some sort of linkage there, but that sentence is really unclear. And so we still feel a little bit fuzzy about what that connection will be. And it may just be that there's an adaptive management program and ultimately the findings from adaptive management will eventually influence real-time operations, but maybe that connection could just be more clearly articulated in the documentation. And then the precautionary principle, we understand that that's just part of the way you implement Section 7, and we appreciate that you were explicit about adherence to the precautionary principle, but it was a little bit vague about how that would play out in decision-making, given the combination of certainty about quite a number of negative effects and uncertainty about other potential effects. We're just wondering where the precautionary principle fits in, wondering if you can provide examples of how it would affect decision-making in practice.
In response to the question about the status of the species and critical habitat, environmental baseline reflect the best available science. Overall, there's really been a massive accumulation of that information, particularly in the NIMS buy-up documentation. There are some instances of issues of consistency, such as the timing of the adult spring Chinook relative to entrainment and impingement at the North Delta Divergence and their vulnerability to pile-driving effects. The information on the life history diversity of salmon genetic stocks is somewhat buried, and sort of given its importance to population resilience, you might consider a comprehensive table that describes the spatial and temporal variation in the various life history traits that where there's data existing. So life size frequency distributions, residence time, ecology, and survival would really help give people an idea of where those different life history types fit in versus potentially what the variability is over time and space in their occurrence and use of the river delta and bay, and some indication of their vulnerability to impact. Next. So how well is the best available science used in the effects analysis and the findings? Considering the limitations of some of the sparse data, particularly for the smelts, the best available science is appropriately utilized for effects analysis and findings. Effects on salmon, smelts, and sturgeon were supported by comprehensive analyses, and the new data and modeling were used in the biop in addition to earlier analyses. And appreciated the fact that more life history types were identified and treated, particularly in the salmonid side of things. There's some elements of effects analysis, such as mechanisms of acoustic stress and variable responses in fishes, were, again, very complete, appeared to capture much of the available, if not all the available, critical and appropriate publications of that science. Many of the avoidance and minimization measures appear to be well established and directly applicable, again, particularly for the construction documentation. There are a few questionable uses of the biophysical data. For example, in evaluating upstream effects, the use of monthly averages for both temperature and flow, given uncertain results, such as the calcium monthly flow, which is a mechanism related to rapid change in flow. So we might need to take a close look at how some of those variables are treated in the analysis.
So this sub-question addresses the effects analysis and the assumptions that went into it. And you'll find that we address these various assumptions at different points during our presentation. But one of the things that is most important to realize and was readily acknowledged by the Fish and Wildlife Service biop is that the flow operations are going to change. There's a high likelihood that responses to the 2008 biop that are being implemented in the near future are going to cause a changed inflow scenario before construction, and therefore, as good as the effects analysis may have been, you have to keep in mind that they're sort of going to be obsolete by the time the construction begins. We will detail one, Greg here will detail one assumption that he was concerned with.
Overall, some assumptions could have been spelled out a little bit more clearly. For example, with salmon, a key issue is using surrogates, and in the case of looking at survival, there's a tremendous amount of information that Russ Perry has presented on survival based on large hatchery yearling late fall Chinook salmon. The group does a great job evaluating those data. Where they can provide additional detail is to what extent might that bias results pertaining to the other species, as in particular the smaller individuals, much smaller individuals compared to those large fish that are tagged. The other part of it is I think it's important to recognize in the impact analysis that these the very good survival analyses that the BIOP is presenting does not necessarily consider the long-term changes in the delta habitat that's associated with, for example, the water withdrawal from the North Delta. Next slide. The next question we have is how extensively are the gaps in aquatic species life history information considered and addressed? For salmon, we were pleased to see that the new life cycle model incorporated five life history types for winter Chinook salmon, although we mentioned the issues with surrogate species that and how that, the late fall Chinook will apply to the winter Chinook, but also I think you'll probably be using those same fish for looking at spring run Chinook and steelhead, perhaps, when those models are developed. And then, again, the key issue is more discussion of impacts and uncertainty regarding those small fry and fingerlings. For example, the fish that are as small as 30 millimeters or so entering the delta up to about 70 millimeters.
For delta smelt, the principal gap in life history is the spawning habitat, which is based on comparison with closely related species believed to be sand or other coarse sediment in parts of the system that have adequate flow, very low salinities or fresh water. We found that this concern over spawning habitat was consistently considered throughout the Fish and Wildlife Service BIOP.
So given the difficulty of quantifying and tracking the amount of individuals of each of those life history stages for each of the fish species, the use of the terms, small proportion and medium proportion and large proportion appears to be appropriate, probably the best that can be utilized at this stage without more quantitative information. And this allows cross-comparison amongst the stocks and ESUs with a different data completeness or quality. But I think, as we mentioned, the description of the variability in the life history stage composition, especially in juvenile migrant habitat use in riverine floodplains and across deltas, needs to be more complete and needs to be fleshed out.
Okay, and again, John Van Sickle, who wasn't available today, also had comments on this section, and he said that the salmon BIOP includes recent statistical modeling by Perry et al., 2017, predicting through delta travel times, survival and migration routing for salmon smolts. Estimations of prediction uncertainty could be added to these analyses. And the same comment applies to the interior delta entrainment probability estimates and the DSM-2 discharge bias corrections of Perry et al. At the USGS report. And I wanted to expand on the Perry et al. USGS report just to add a little bit of extra understanding. When in the figure, this was supplemental material that was given to us. And figure 15 of that report, we saw the discrepancy between what DSM-2 is representing for flow at Georgiana Slough, or excuse me, this is Walnut Grove, below Walnut Grove, I think that is the Georgiana Slough station. So you can see the blue line is the
the DSM-2 results, and the black line is the U.S. gauge, and then the red line is their prediction that they did. But what was for me was concerning here was that DSM-2 model, the flows in this area are not correctly representing the entrainment in this area, and it is a vital importance that your hydrodynamic models, which are the base of this system, be correctly representing what's going on there. So I think, especially in this open file report, I didn't see it had a number yet on it. I think if it could be, some more details could be expanded on as far as the assumptions made with the DSM-2 runs as far as what exactly is being represented in this area. And this is something I talked to Russ Perry about a little bit more.
Oh, and then this is just a general comment about data gaps and uncertainties, just pointing out that both draft BIOPs so far seem to rely pretty heavily on adaptive management to address data gaps and uncertainties. For example, the NIMS document says that the adaptive management program will address uncertainties associated with the effectiveness of management actions taken to avoid jeopardy and adverse modification, and quote, and meet other regulatory standards applicable to state-listed species for ongoing operations of the State Water Project, Central Valley Project, habitat restoration actions required for water fix and or the State Water the Projects, and CESA authorizations, et cetera, et cetera. And then the NIMS document also provides examples of the kinds of things that the services will focus on and potentially adjust using adaptive management, including water operations. And the panel just wants to note that the most significant overarching uncertainty is how robustly the adaptive management plans as written will be implemented. It entirely depends on the decision-making authority, and it does leave a lot to the discretion of the IICG. We could use a little bit of more clarity on the question of whether NIMS and Fish and Wildlife Service are relying on the robustness of the adaptive management program in order to ensure future compliance with regulatory standards. So it needs some clarification there.
What about the other? Are you going to do the question? Or did that? Yeah. The fourth overall question was, given the preliminary design specifications for construction of the WaterFix project, how adequate are the analyses of effects of the various construction activities on the species in the biop? And the first sub-question that we addressed is, have the biops identified which construction-related effects pose a repeated and considerable effect on the species. The Fish and Wildlife Service biological opinion stated that construction designs have not been finalized, they're quite preliminary, and were generally insufficient to provide a detailed analysis of effects, and therefore the Fish and Wildlife Service largely deferred their analysis of construction-related effects to future consultations. In contrast, the NOAA BIOP provided quite a bit of analysis of construction-related impacts. This long list that you probably can't read, I know I can't read it up there. They went through quite a bit of text and information to address these different construction-related effects, such as predation at the barge landings, large volumes of barge traffic throughout the delta, extensive pile driving at a number of different construction sites, cofferdam construction and associated predation-related mortality, predation at the Clifton Court Forebay, exposure, additional chemical exposure when sediments are being dredged or otherwise stirred up. I was pleased to see that there was an impact analysis on the non-ESA listed fall Chinook and late fall Chinook, because this is a species that could be important to ESA listed killer whales. We note, as the BIOP did note, that there were significant and repeated exposure of steelhead and adult fall Chinook salmon to impact pile driving noise that could lead to a severe significant adverse impact. And although there are minimization measures to minimize those pile driving noise effects from impact hammer, you know, the use of bubbles and the vibration hammer are not likely to be sufficient to offset those adverse impacts to steelhead and fall Chinook. There's a lot of detail on the pile driving, which is good, but the report could have summarized those effects. For example, just a table of the number of piles being driven. There's thousands and thousands of piles being driven, but it's hard to see the overall level of impact driving that was occurring. And then lastly, as we mentioned yesterday, there was some a little bit of conflicting information on the timing of adult spring Chinook passing through the Delta and whether or not they would be passing through the work window, which is from June through October. The second sub-question here is which construction-related effects will be most challenging to mitigate, either by methods proposed by the BA or other methods. I would suggest that any factor that affects survival, especially survival over the long term of the species, will be difficult to mitigate. And I say this because from experience of our evaluations in the Columbia River Basin, habitat restoration is good, but it's also difficult to empirically relate that habitat restoration to a survival productivity benefit. Habitat impacts, for the most part, according to the BA, are being mitigated at a 3-to-1 ratio. And as we mentioned yesterday, this raising the question, is that sufficient mitigation ratio for species that are protected or listed under the Endangered Species Act that they're, because they're so depleted? Need to consider that it takes time, especially in certain systems, for habitat restoration to occur. And it's important to develop a mitigation plan, habitat restoration plan, and begin that mitigation as soon as possible. From what we heard, that is the current plan, addressing some of the mitigation activities related to the 2008 biop. It's worth noting that as far as we were presented here in this biop, there were no mitigation measures proposed for pile driving impacts, impingement and on the fish screens, contaminant, resuspension, physical injury due to in the construction time period, predation risk during construction and operation, and also the operational effects that impact the redistribution of salmon in response to changes in salinity and available habitat. We know that cofferdams at the North Diversion Dam construction site will increase the river velocity and block or impede the upstream migration of spawning Delta smelt, but there are no options for mitigation proposed at this time. And the Fish and Wildlife Service stated that the consultation would be reinitialized if the use of those cofferdams to build the screens was not feasible. And I don't recall seeing that aspect in the NOAA biop. But and lastly, it's important that, this is a critical point, that the monitoring is needed to ensure mitigation activities are adequately implemented and that those mitigation activities are having the expected benefit to the species. This is a key aspect of the adaptive management approach.
And so just following on that, we understand that you're in the process of revising the adaptive management framework, and it might be a good idea to include in there, if you're not already, mention about how adaptive management will be used to monitor construction impacts in order to mitigate them and also monitor, as Greg said, the effectiveness of the mitigation and performance.
The fifth overall question we were asked is how adequately do the draft BIOPS address the key operational effects of the proposed action? And the first sub-question was, how well do the analyses provide sound information to adequately characterize the effects of the North Delta diversion operations on outmigrating salmonids and sturgeon? First comment is just simply that, the complexity of these analyses by life stage and the biological assessment and the California ESA permit document highlight the need for a comprehensive life cycle model. We made this comment in our phase 2A report and in previous reports, and so we were pleased that NOAA Fisheries developed a much more comprehensive life cycle model, because it's impossible to link together the various impacts at each one of these life stages, and so you can look at the overall cumulative effect of the project on the population status of the species. So NOAA developed this new life cycle model and applied it to winter Chinook in the biological opinion, and they also incorporated new analyses of survival by Russ Perry, using the late hatchery fall Chinook salmon, which was quite impressive. One of our comments in phase 2A was to update a lot of the data that are being used for the survival analyses because they seem to be limited to earlier data sets. But in the new analysis here, they used over 2,000 tagged Chinook salmon to document the survival based on tagging operations from 2007 to 2011. So pleased to see that a lot of the more recent data were incorporated into this analysis. The life cycle model also, as Cy mentioned earlier, incorporated five life history patterns and examined the proposed project action effects across the life cycle of winter Chinook salmon. We expect, and I know the scientists doing the life cycle model, expect it to evolve over time with new data, and they'll make improvements over time, but I think this is a great start to evaluate the impacts. And they demonstrated to us yesterday that they can use the model to explore potential water diversion scenarios in an effort to potentially reduce operation-related mortality, and while also achieving the water demands potentially. As we mentioned earlier, the BIOP should discuss the use of these large hatchery fish as surrogates for winter and spring and possibly Chinook steelhead life cycle models. As I've discussed with the NIMS scientists, it would be useful to better explain the mechanism for greater project effects on the lower river smolts compared to, say, the delta smolts. Just go through that a little bit more carefully, because it's an important aspect for us to learn about what might be happening here, and also to clarify how the model represents Chinook salmon that are greater than 70 millimeters. And then lastly, this is a new, and I know they've been working on it for a couple of years, but it, like any of these highly technical documents, would be worthwhile to conduct an external peer review. Also, I think it was very useful that the BIOP incorporated a new water temperature analysis during the egg incubation period based on a study by NIMS scientist Martin et al. Incorporated that new information into the biological opinion. And then continuing on, the BIOP needs to address operational effects, especially on smaller juvenile salmonids, for example, 30, 70 millimeter salmonids. Those very small fish are probably less frequent, but if you go to the Fish and Wildlife Service webpage and do a simple pivot analysis, you can see Chinook salmon as small as 31 millimeters or so caught in beach seines in the Delta area. These fry and fingerlings of this size are especially vulnerable to water removal because they live in shallower water near the shoreline areas and possibly near the North Diversion structures. And also less information is available on these fry and fingerlings. The models should also evaluate project effects on the spatial structure and diversity a spring-run Chinook salmon. I suspect that they will when they get into looking at the spring-run Chinook in greater detail. Critical habitat was evaluated generically for salmon and sturgeon, freshwater rearing sites, and the freshwater migration corridors and estuaries. So forth. Let's see. Nancy.
Okay. So another question, comment that came under, how well did the analysis provide sound information to adequately characterize the effects of the North Delta Diversion operations on out-migrating salmon. And in Perry's report, it said it's generally understood that the diversion, North Delta Diversion would be operated in real time to prevent reverse flows at Georgiana Slough for that entrainment. And to their knowledge, such rules had not yet been developed or evaluating the tools such as DSM-2. And one of the things I wanted to point out is that the junction of Georgiana Slough, Delta Cross Channel, Sacramento is a really tricky location. And it's hard to model. It's really hard to model. I struggled with it with my modeling. But the one thing that I've learned is that that place is the transition from unidirectional flow to bidirectional flow. And I don't think it is realistic to think that operating on real time that you are going to be changing your entrainment rates at that location. You're sending a signal down from all the way at the North Delta down to that location, and it's a tidal signal. So this was a place where I think the comments is, well, that's something we can fix later with our operations. And what I would say here is this is not a place you can fix it because the physics are against you in this particular case. Okay. The other big question was how do we adequately characterize the effects of the Delta Diversion? And this was something that I touched on yesterday. And the thing that we noticed yesterday was with the routing was that when you changed the Delta, the amount of water exported at the North Delta facilities, you ended up with a lower flow, and therefore your Delta cross channel was allowed to stay open where before it was closed. And you can see this in these two colorful figures. I really like these figures, and where you can see the red up above is how many times the routing goes into the Delta cross channel, where below is with Delta operations going on, with North Delta facility operations going on, where below is with the no Delta alternative. And the question then is, the big picture question is, will the Delta cross channel be operated in the same way as it has been in the past? Should there be a criteria for closing to take account of flow above the Delta cross channel? That should not say above DCCC. That should say above the diversion facilities. And here we're starting to get into a promise, a benefit. You know, for salmon, you want that gate closed. For water quality, you want that gate open. So here's going to be a place where you're going to have conflict with other agencies and other purposes for that operation. And this is going to be an operation criteria you're going to have to look at really closely as you move forward. And these are the type of things that you should be looking at when you're seeing the results. And what does this mean for our operations in the future?
So this sub-question is another one that is specifically targeting the North delta diversion, looking for possible improvements in the analytical approach that could inform management and infrastructure. And the panel found in particular that the approach of conducting pre-construction and post-construction surveys is a particularly robust one. I think there are about 8 pre-construction studies that were described in the Fish and Wildlife Service biop that would address the empirical relationships with things like sediment transport, tidal interaction with the diversion, refugia from predation, and the hydraulic performance of the fish screens. And that's complemented with a series of studies that would be conducted over longer time periods to, you know, for months to the length of the permit, that would assess actual entrainment, actual impingement, and screen design performance. These several more studies were would involve survival of juvenile salmonids and the two smelts, and also address changes in predator density at the site of the diversions. These are described as starting before construction and continuing afterwards for at least 3 years. So again, this before and after type of study was approved of by the panel as being robust. The next question, sub-question 5C, is more general and deals with whether or not we've the biops captured all of the risks, whether some were overlooked, or if scientific information had not been considered at both the individual and population level. And if you think about the previous answer that we provided, you know, what if predators are found to accumulate impingement is higher than expected? You know, what can actually be done? So at that point, after construction, one substantial risk is that the AM program in general would not have the capacity or authority to do anything about it. So that's a kind of an overarching comment about that question, and we'll have several more slides that address other details.
Okay. I'm going to be a little bit redundant here, but here we go. You know, overall, these analyses and the biops were comprehensive and well-described. Adverse impacts on the fish were identified for both construction in terms of the NOAA biop and also the operations. The new NOAA life cycle model and survival analyses by Perry and the Martin water temperature analyses were significant improvements in describing or evaluating impacts of the project. The life cycle model needs to be extended to other species while also justifying the surrogate species approach. It was recognized, or it was good that the biop recognized in the salmon analyses that a small adverse effect could have significant population impacts on the species. And so that's an important aspect, especially when dealing with these depleted ESA-listed stocks. Just a small adverse impact can have a significant population effect. The critical habitat analysis was fairly comprehensive, but I think it should also consider the alteration that's caused by the removal of water and those complex interactions that occur among the salinity, the vegetation, and other habitat features that support rearing salmon. In other words, to what extent does the water diversion alter the distribution of salmon below the diversion dam in relation to available habitat?
Another answer to 5C deals more directly with delta smelt and again, the Fish and Wildlife Service was very open about their approach and being largely qualitative interpretation of analyses that had already been conducted as part of the BA, although they did a number of new analyses. And one of the conclusions was that very few adult delta smelt would be expected to survive upstream passage by all three intake sites, resulting, in their words, in a contraction of the delta smelt's historical range. The Fish and Wildlife Service BIOP also acknowledged that this issue will be worsened by future salinity intrusions caused by drought or climate change. Next slide. Another primary conclusion regarding delta smelt, which is largely based on their new analyses of X2 responses to inflow, identified repeated separations between delta smelt and their open water rearing habitat in the downstream bay-like areas, particularly during certain months. Given those two effects, they summarized the risk to delta smelt as the effects of the PA on critical habitat and the current and future cumulative effects will prevent the ability of delta smelt designated critical habitat to serve its intended conservation role for the species and will preclude the species recovery. And the final bullet is inaccurate. We have a number of other comments that we'd like to make about risk. So there's also a concern that the downstream effects of the North Delta diversions on essential fish habitat was not completely assessed. Things like water level changes at spawning sites used by both delta smelt and longfin smelt, and restoration effects that might change the tidal prism. So even when you're downstream in areas that have a lot of tidal influence, if you've changed the geomorphology somehow through restoration efforts and changed the quantity of water that moves in and out, you can certainly change water levels. So it's not just the freshwater flow that might affect water level in spawning grounds or other sensitive rearing areas, but also the restoration itself.
This is another thing that we talked about yesterday, and I just wanted to reemphasize is that as you're doing your analysis and you are coming up with numbers for X2, it's really important to think about what does that X2 represent. So you need to have a better explanation of how X2 describes the interaction between the physical environment and the biology. For instance, this is one of the presentation slides we had yesterday, and I suggest that you put a line around X2 equals about 85 as a point where it's a transition zone, from with X2 less than 81, there's access to Honker Bay and the other open water habitats, so you have longer residence time, rather than the engineered channels, which will have a short residence time. And one of the things that Cy suggested was that you might want to calculate the number of months when X2 is greater than 81 kilometers in your reporting. So we're down to the last question. So and this has mostly input from John Van Sickle and myself. So the question was, how clear is the proposed approach to establish longfin smelt outflow criteria for assuring spring outflow as modeled in the CESA permit application and presented as part of Phase 2A of the California WaterFix Aquatic Peer Review? And the main thing that we want to say is that the underlying mechanism for the longfin smelt abundance and delta outflow relationship is a critical research topic. And really it should be put as a high priority. Because brain, and one of the things that we heard in the phase 2A public comment was that the spring outflow criteria causes a conflict between water supply and longfin smelt protection. So as we're coming up with these different criteria, we really have to keep in mind that there is a balance between what we do for the fish and what we do for water supply, and it is and for other people that this is an important issue for them. The development of the minimum delta outflow criteria for the spring period, February, March through May, that would be similar to what occurs under the current authorizations for the Central Valley Project and State Water Project, could help minimize the effects of the California water fix on longfin smelt. As far as the presentation yesterday, the presentation for modeling longfin outflow criteria was murky and disjointed, and that presentation needs to be significantly improved before this concept is presented in other forums for review. It was difficult for all the panelists to follow that presentation. However, John Van Sickle had a few comments that he wanted to make, and that which we also stated yesterday, was that the 8-river index to the delta outflow relationship was modeled as an exponentially increasing function of 8-river index, while the original presentation that we were provided assumed a quadratic modeled structure. And there's a subtlety in this that he wanted to make sure we stated, and that was the two model structures probably fit the data about equally well, and they'll make similar predictions, but it's important to, as you're coming up with initial concepts, to base it on what may be physical processes instead of just trying to get a good data fit. John said the 8-river index is proportional to the sum flows of the 8 rivers, and the delta outflow must also be equal to those sum flows plus or minus various withdrawals and additions due to irrigation, reservoir management, etc. And the argument for a linear, maybe plus a quadratic model would become stronger from the data pattern alone. The regression, he also stated, based on simulated outflows instead of just using the observed flows, almost surely overstates the tightness of the relationship between the actual future outflows and the 8-river index. So, Sai, do you want to come conclude?
I think that pretty much draws things to a close. I think we're open for exchanges. Questions and answers? Or you want to break?
Yeah, so in the agenda we have a break scheduled for half an hour, and I'll propose we take that break, but I do want to comment first. I think I didn't mention earlier that if you'd like to make public comment on the contents of this review, that'll be taken at the end of the day. We will take just about a half an hour break. We'll start back at 3:30 with a discussion between the review panel and the presenters from yesterday. So if the presenters from yesterday would find a seat at the table when we come back at 3:30, that would be great. So we're on a break now. All right, welcome back from the break. This next section of the agenda is really a discussion between the panel and the presenters from yesterday. So I'm going to, I'll be here to help facilitate, but also just chime in and I think maybe first responses from the presenters to the panel's discussion. And then if you would like to make public comment, please fill out a blue slip that's located by the sign-in sheet and provide it to me sometime during the discussion. We'll take public comment before we close today.
How's that? Is that pretty good? I can start. I wanted to maybe just have a little discussion about the surrogate questions that were raised in terms of, you know, using large hatchery origin, late fall Chinook for inferences on winter run. So you said, is there a mouse up here or? Okay. So I put up a figure here, and what this is showing, just to understand how our estimates from acoustic telemetry data compare to other sources of data, this is comparing Ken Newman's 2003 model, which was based on coated wire tagged fish, that's from his 2003 paper, to an analysis that I had done back in 2010 for the same reach from the Sacramento River downstream of the Delta Cross Channel of the Chips Island, and completely different non-overlapping sizes. Our average size was 156 and his was 81. But when we compare the relationships, both found an effective size on survival and of flow, when we compare the relationships at a common size, they actually compare very well. So I just wanted to show that to the panel. You know, and I think what's, so that's important, but we're also using the model essentially at the mean size of these large fish. And so I think what's important to take home from our analyses is not necessarily the absolute survival, because that's lower, as you can see, for smaller fish, but are the relative inferences going to be sound? Would we expect lower survival at lower flow for smaller fish? And you would. So I think, you know, relative differences are more sound, whereas absolute differences in survival for small fish might potentially be more important for the life cycle model. So anyway, I just wanted to bring this up as a way of helping to understand the surrogacy issue and the large fish, small fish issue.
I would just say this is good, and it would just make the biop more complete, just to put in a few sentences about these comparisons that you guys know about, but mm-hmm. people reading the biop haven't seen yet. But.
I have a couple other things, but I can, if someone else wants to jump in for a bit, I'm fine with that. Come on, everyone. No.
Not everyone speak at once. Just wanted to say thank you again to the panel. These comments were really helpful, and we'll definitely be working through them. That's okay. As we're refining the biop. There was one clarification I wanted to make, and that was in regards to slide 21. I think we know there was confusion regarding our phasing approach, and we thought that your comment yesterday about creating a schematic would be really helpful, so we're going to be working on that. I did want to take a second run at trying to explain the phasing approach, just in regards to this comment. So this draft biological opinion will be covering all construction level effects for phase one. Phase one does not include construction of the North Delta diversion or the head of Old River Gate, but it does include all other construction, so construction of the tunnels primarily. As we talked about yesterday, the phase one and phase two are based on the Corps' permitting approach. But for us specifically, in terms of our guidance, phase two applies where there's a subsequent federal approval. So we are looking at phase one as being the first round of activities that will not require a subsequent federal approval, and phase two will be activities that will have that subsequent federal approval. For the Corps, that will be their phase two actions. And the language on the slide, that states that construction designs haven't been finalized enough to allow evaluation of effects. I think that was a statement that was in regard to a couple of specific things, which was mitigation, maintenance, monitoring, and adaptive management. And those are areas that we've acknowledged that we need more information, and they'll be part of future consultations. But we hope that there was sufficient information regarding the rest of the construction level effects in this analysis. So just wanted to clarify that.
And we appreciate getting some kind of schematic, because that really would help us in our understanding of where this fits into the whole process.
Hi, thank you again for your guys' comments. Just adding to slide 22, we won't put you on the spot today, but getting any additional recommendations on conservation measures that you guys have related to compensatory mitigation for offsetting all the effects of the project would greatly be appreciated in your final report.
So yes, all right, I can go again since there's some silence here, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about the operation, the real-time operations of the pumps in terms of not increasing the frequency of duration of reverse flows. So in the North Delta Bypass rules, it explicitly states that operation of the diversion will not act to increase the frequency and duration of reverse flows. And so we did this analysis as part of our report that Nancy mentioned, which shows up at the top here the daily probability of a flow reversal. Does a flow reversal occur on a given day as a function of Sacramento River discharge? And in the bottom panel here, we're showing the proportion of each day with negative flow just downstream of Georgiana Slough, because this has a big influence on the probability of fish entering the interior delta. And so in terms of, if you were to stick strictly to that statement of not increasing frequency and duration of reverse flows, then bypass flows essentially would have to be, where these lines drop down to essentially close to zero about 25,000 CFS here for the proportion of the day, or, somewhere between 22.5 and 25,000 here at Freeport, which is a pretty relatively high discharge. If you were to say you cannot divert at that, if you cannot divert because it'll increase the duration and frequency of reverse flows. So I think Ryan jump in here, but I think we're basically looking for some guidance on what some alternative criteria might be to operate the diversion, recognizing that we're going to be somewhere in this range where there will be an increase in the frequency and duration of reverse flows.
I think that, I guess my point is that you're just in a tough zone, because that you are in the tidal zone. Now, as you do restoration, you may end up, if you do restoration down in Sassoon Bay, that will change your tidal range. And when you change your tidal range, then this whole thing can change quickly. So this is why it's important, as you do restoration, to get that implemented into your hydrodynamic modeling and really understand that there is a coupling between those. I wanted to make sure that you don't say, this is something that's just a fact of modeling, because we're using daily average values, and that we're going to do something on a real-time basis to change it. Because I think you need to explore it more, especially with DSM-2 is a very easy way to do the exploration. I think it's very valuable now to start doing that, because that may not be a criteria that you can actually follow through on, because of it, physically that's just how the system is. So that's just where the transition is.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. John Bureau, a colleague of mine at the USGS, has been a big proponent of targeted restoration, not only for habitat, but for, you know, intentionally modifying the tidal forcing, because you could actually shift this curve to the left, essentially at a given inflow to reduce tidal forcing. So that could be one approach in terms of mitigation for increase in frequency and duration.
So you may end up being lucky, and it just by having to do restoration, it may help you out with that part.
So I just want to say I appreciate your comment about the looking at the big picture. But I do want to point out, so we do plan on, of course, including a schematic, according to your suggestion, to help sort of tie together the pieces and the phases. Specifically related to the cumulative effects at the delta scale, just want to point out we're somewhat constrained in the context of a biop to sort of look, you know, too far out at sort of at other actions that maybe aren't directly related to Cal Water Fix. So this is something I think that we need to look into and working closely with the state and the federal action agencies to make sure we don't lose sight of that big picture. So I just want to say we appreciate that comment, and that's something we do plan to follow up on, but we are somewhat constrained in the biop to do that. Thank you.
Slide number 35. For the North Delta diversions and the downstream effects, and as to whether or not this was just related to the critical habitat or also the species level analyses for Delta smelt, whether or not both sections need improvements on that or just the critical habitat section.
So I think my suggestion was you were just showing all the relationship of X2 over time, and I just thought that putting a line there on your figures just gives you a sense of reality. It points out a benchmark for mm-hmm. you to that is a benchmark where you really need to think that this has a physical implications for that switch over location. Sai, did you have any other?
And as for the downstream portion of the North Delta diversions and the effects there, was that covered, you think, in both sections or just needs improvement within the critical habitat section? Because I think you'd referred to it as the potential restoration downstream could affect the North Delta diversions in terms of shallow water habitat below the diversions.
Well, actually, it gets back to the question we were just talking about. What John Brewer talked about is sort of the strategic placement of restoration could make a big difference. So the scenarios for both the North Delta diversion withdrawals and the combination with restoration where it is occurring could make a big difference in terms of water level fluctuation. Which is going to be a big driver for a number of the habitat utilizations of the different species.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I was the messenger on that one. That
okay.
was Sai's comment.
Okay.
So just a point on that, as part of BDCP, which had much loftier restoration goals than what's in EcoRestore, but it had a large amount of acreage restored in Cache Slough, which did have a hydrodynamic effect on reverse flows at Georgiana Slough by reducing the tidal excursion up the Sacramento River. So, and that, I think, in the long term, will be where quite a bit of tidal restoration occurs, irrespective. So certainly it's a good caution to keep in mind as we go forward as it affects, and I think we're starting to to understand, I think, as I mentioned yesterday, about the kind of effects of restoration in different parts of the Delta, what those, how that manifests itself. And we're starting to pick up on, we've got to kind of model all of them together, not just discreetly.
And I would include floodplain Yolo bypass equivalents as well in that, assuming you're already sort of looking at the expansion of Yolo bypass, its effects.
Nancy, can I ask a quick question on the DSM-2 bias corrections, your comments there?
Yeah.
So is your contention essentially that DSM-2 should be fixed to eliminate the bias, or that our approach to correcting for the bias was inappropriate?
It was more the concern of seeing that DSM-2 not fitting, and that that's a concern, because there's a lot of modeling, there's a lot of other things that build on top of that. So I think there was something said where, well, we used that one because that was linked to some other model, some CalSim modeling that was done, and we didn't want to go on to using the next model up. As far as it would have been nice in the report to know if the DSM-2 results were for a case where you had the North Delta diversion operating, or what knobs were turned at that moment, and it could have been that by operating the diversions or something like that, it gave you a different signal than, since you were doing observe, that this wasn't a North Delta diversion ops situation. So
actually, this comparison is for the historical simulation with version 8.0.6, so that we could evaluate against observed conditions.
Right. Okay.
But essentially, that's the version that was used to conduct the 82-year simulations for DSM-2, and as part of the Cal Water fix. And so those were the outputs that were provided to us for us to then do our analysis. So that's that's kind of the flow, the workflow of, okay, now this is what we have to work with, and there's this discrepancy that's going to influence our modeling if we don't account for it. But so essentially, we need DSM-2 needs to be fixed.
It's more that as a modeler and as a delta hydrodynamic modeler, I see that and I go, oops.
Well, that is going to
there's something not right.
Right.
Anyway, we probably could talk just offline about it, but mm-hmm. I was just interested in more of the detail than was actually available in that report.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So again, I want to thank you for your input, and particularly as it relates to the long fence melt. I think just a point I want to make is in regard to the comment on slide 37, as it relates to the outflow abundance relationship for long fence melt, that I think is an ongoing area of significant future research. And I think, we have tried to indicate in the framework that was something that we were going to spend a lot of energy on. I think based on the ongoing comments on the adaptive management process, that there are some things that we can do to more concisely identify the priority issues than have been in the existing framework in a simple way and kind of say what we're going to do about them. And hopefully that will get at some of your concerns about what we've done to date without making it another 200 pages. But I think just to reiterate that that's going to be a focal point for the reasons that are identified in the slide, because of their water supply effect and that all, I think, with regard to the approach to developing criteria to meet or maintain what we see currently, we don't have a criteria we have the product of multiple actions that are part of the existing biological opinions. They weren't intended to provide outflow, but they do, and that's what we're trying to achieve. And so we have taken the approach of developing a method that doesn't rely on forecasting as a way of predicting or providing operational criteria. It really doesn't have anything to do with the relation, the flow-abundance relationship, other than providing some criteria that can be used to operate the projects to meet an outflow objective. So I think we appreciate, you know, your input on that. I think we probably made it much more complicated than it needed to be in our presentation as how we went about doing it. But, you know, the kind of the underlying issue is we wanted to come up with a way of establishing some criteria in a way that you could look it up as opposed to relying on something that's a future forecast.
And I think that's great. That's great. This is very preliminary, and I am planning in the next few weeks to really sit down and look at the modeling and look at your approach and give some feedback on it, because I think that's very, very valuable. And I think there's some good stuff in there, but it's just hard to synthesize it at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good afternoon. I also want to echo the thanks to the panel for your presentation. You did a great job diving into the details of a lot of materials thrown at you right before the holidays, and we really appreciate all the work you put in. I just wanted to make a brief comment in response to a number of the comments that the panel has said, both in Phase 2A, actually, and with this 2B regarding the development of triggers. You know, NIMS, we're definitely aware of the importance of those, and what I think we plan to do is, as we carry through our analysis through the full draft file, taking into account your comments, we're going to utilize our incidental take statement as kind of the foundation for that, and what will drive that, and build those triggers into both the adaptive management framework, and that will eventually be finalized, as well as be very clear in the final draft file, what are the triggers for reinitiation of consultation. So, just wanted to highlight that wasn't a section that was completed for the purposes of your review, but that's how we plan to address that going forward.
We have plenty of time for the panel.
To follow up. So, so how will the Fish and Wildlife Service handle that triggers for the smelt? Will that also be in the incidental take statement? And do you know yet what you'll use for triggers, since that seemed to be a challenge?
So, as it relates to where there's incidental take, trying to remember where we included them, but I know that we included them more than once in the biop as it relates to the standard consultation piece. So I know that we included them in the effects section. I believe we included the ITS, but I'm not positive. I'd have to look back at that. But we tried to be clear about where we expected that, based on further refinement of the specifics of the action, where we thought there might be triggers. But yeah, there. I know it's in the effects section.
Do you know? Yeah. Kind of curious. How would you evaluate whether or not there's incidental take on the smelt?
Both in ways of number of species and the habitat. So they will be going out and monitoring the physical footprints of the proposed action and whether or not they'll be going over the exceedance of the habitat that they've identified in the effects analysis, as well as the effects to the individuals that they've identified in the effects to the action. And sorry you didn't receive the take statement as this portion, and that would probably shed some more light on the way in which we're characterizing the take for the species.
Greg, I wanted to ask a question about a clarification on slide 26. The last bullet, you talked about critical habitat description. At the end of that sentence, you mentioned should also reflect life history variation. I just wanted some clarification on exactly what was meant there.
That's probably my comment. I think that one of the important things is particularly in appreciating how populations either mechanistically or genetically or fortuitously respond in sort of varying or ending up varying their life history patterns. In addition to a spatial structure, which you're already approaching very well, is a temporal variation in that. So in other words, what can you explain performance of one life history type uniformly across cohorts and years, or does that vary significantly, and are some of the drivers of that variation environmental, particularly, you know, wet years, dry years, other management actions? So sort of understanding how variable that is over time is just as important as understanding how variable it is spatially.
So as far as critical habitat analysis, does that mean that you think we should show, for instance, the different how fry would be using a freshwater rearing habitat versus how smolts would be using it?
Right. Okay. And how that might shift from year to year in terms mm-hmm. of timing, if not variability amongst years, and how, you know, for instance, with winter run, you know, how much of that is driven by management in the spawning areas and the riverine rearing areas as compared to natural flow and other aspects. So I think, you know, especially with the smaller migrant fry that you really don't have a lot of information on, it'd be sort of interesting to understand not only what role they play in final return to spawner, but, you know, where have they occupied the habitats that contributed to a higher rate of survival for them, in part because they're the ones that they're probably using the delta tidal habitats the most.
Okay, that's helpful.
Might add, as we mentioned elsewhere as well, regarding the critical habitat evaluation and the effects of the project, you know, the water, significant amounts of water will be removed during certain time periods. That's going to change the velocity, water depth in some areas, access to some habitats. But with that change in salinity, that could influence the distribution of the juvenile salmon, especially these smaller individuals. And they're trying to rear in these habitats. If their distribution changes, for example, upstream because of the changes in salinity, how well do these new habitats, are they supported by the existing, how well is the new distribution supported by the existing habitat features that are there? There will be an alteration in their habitat because of the change in distribution. It's kind of tricky to figure out if it's an adverse impact or not, but you need to take a look at that. I think that was one area that you describe a lot of the habitat features, but this complex interaction between the water, the salinity, and where the fish are rearing now compared to where they will be distributed after the project.
Okay.
It's complicated. Thanks. To figure out, but
I maybe have a follow-up question about that, whether I can form a coherent question about that. I'll have to struggle through this because I'm confused a little bit. So the life cycle model actually makes predictions about, actually pretty explicit ones, about how we expect winter chinook to respond in those kinds of ways, because it has a salinity threshold, X10 is what we use there, which we think delimits the downstream distribution. But they're pretty limited in coarse data to compare that to, and then we're really talking about a future that has no analog in the present or past, so there's really nothing to compare it about. And are those kinds of things useful, and is that what you're suggesting here on slide 26? Or is there some other kinds of analyses that are maybe more tied into data and reality about fry that we should be working on?
Well, in a simple case, in some estuaries I've worked on, there's in sampling juveniles up and down the estuary and lower river, we can often find higher densities in certain areas and what we like to call a transition zone, you know, where the freshwater is meeting saltwater. I mean, if you were sampling in this delta area and found areas like that, then the question will be, okay, well, after we modify the environment, the project takes place and you're removing water, what will happen to that type of habitat that they seem to be attracted to, largely reflecting the water flows and salinity? You know, I haven't carefully glanced at the Fish and Wildlife Service webpage on beach seine data and all that, but I haven't looked at the spatial distribution. Maybe there's not enough sampling and fish availability to look at how they are responding to different habitat types and salinities, but that's how I might approach it.
As we discussed yesterday, a lot of the data that I think is really exceedingly valuable and worth expanding on is the stable isotope indications of sources, and which would give you sort of stage pathways through mm-hmm. the system. Especially if you could couple that to modeling of how, you know, without shunting a lot of fish into the central delta, that you're distributing them down into new areas for rearing. And again, how would the placement of mitigation restoration influence their residence time, which right now you're sort of in general showing as decreasing survival, but for these fry, you might find that it minimizes or even increases survival. So it'd be sort of trying to project to the future based on the way the fish are behaving right now, at least mm-hmm. above the delta. And also doing that for the migrating juveniles rather than just depending on the adult signatures and the otoliths. Because you'd like to know, you know, what's the difference between who survived yeah. and who didn't, which I think is, again, going to vary pretty interestingly on an interannual basis. Mm-hmm.
And what Sai's mentioning here is sort of the kind of a split between the life history patterns. A lot of the survival work that Russ is doing is with larger individuals where probably getting out of the estuary might be the best way to do it and enhancing survival. Whereas for small individuals, their survival overall is probably enhanced by rearing in a delta and growing and then moving on to the marine environment.
Some years.
At least in some years.
People are looking at me, and I'm looking around the table to see. I mean, this is, if there are other questions or comments that presenters or the panel would like to ask for more clarification, the panel will be continuing to refine its recommendations. But I do want to give you all the opportunity to use this time. So I'm just going to pause for a moment more. Okay. People are good. Okay. Well, thank you. I guess we'll move on. I did not receive any requests to make public comment. One last opportunity for that. Okay, well, I want to thank everyone who contributed to this review and wanted to highlight a few of, well, give a more detailed thank you to the panel. I think it showed in the discussion today and just such an impressive dedication to this review, juggling multiple phases of a review over the holidays, drafting a report and reviewing hundreds of pages, and receiving documents in the late phases of your time to review material. So thank you so much to the panel, and especially to note participation and dedication from John Van Sickle, from his participation from his holiday in South Africa. So next steps in this review will include the panel continuing to work on their refining their recommendations that were provided in the draft phase 2A report, as well as some of the initial recommendations that were provided today. The presentations that were presented today will probably undergo a few slight revisions that were talked about as they went through the slides, and we'll be posting those on the review webpage following this meeting, probably later this week. So we will put the same sort of disclaimer noting any small differences. So check the review webpage for their final initial recommendations from today. The panel will be working on their final reports, and those are due to select staff of the Delta Science Program on February 27th. And just note that it takes about a week for us to we do a little bit of an editorial review and just make sure the panel's recommendations are in the state that they want for them to be publicly posted. So we will post those on the review webpage as soon as possible following their submission. So thank you very much for tuning in. This archive will be webcast if you want to go back and watch. So thank you very much, and we're adjourned.